Hey, this is John at The Bible Project. We're on episode 5 of a conversation about a character in the Bible called the Son of Man. It's an important character that Jesus himself identifies with. And while the apostles called Jesus by the title the Christ,
an odd fact in the gospel accounts is Jesus almost never uses that title to describe himself. Instead, he very often uses the phrase the Son of Man. This is a phrase that he got from Daniel chapter 7, and it's clear that Jesus saw Daniel 7 as a symbolic portrait in miniature of his entire destiny, calling, and vocation, his identity.
In Daniel 7, there's a dream. In the dream, we meet this character, the Son of Man. He rides up on a cloud, sits at God's right hand, and is worshipped alongside of him. And this is the human we've been waiting for since page 3 of the Bible, when God promised that a seed of the woman would crush the head of the serpent.
But the Son of Man is in Daniel 7, which is the culmination of Daniel 1 through 6. And so we need to take in Daniel 1 through 6.
So that's what we're going to talk about today. In 6th century BC, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, took over Jerusalem, loots their temple, and recruits men to serve him in Babylon. One of these men is Daniel. We'll look at how he is connected to the Son of Man, all that and more in this episode. Thanks for joining us. Here we go. Okay, this is the part you've been waiting for.
Yes, in the Son of Man conversations, everything's been setting up for this. This is where the good stuff is.
Really? Yeah. I felt like the conversation's been good.
Oh, it's been awesome. But it's all been preparatory to come back to where we started and to read Daniel 7, I think, with fresh set of lenses. And then to let that help us reread the gospel accounts of Jesus.
Yeah, you've never done it this way. Start in the middle of the story, go to Jesus.
Correct.
Go back to the beginning of the story.
Yeah.
And then come back.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So here's the recap. So this is preparatory conversations for the Son of Man video we're going to make. We started with a fact. Jesus, the most common title in the New Testament is Messiah or Christ. People using it to describe him. However, an odd fact in the gospel accounts is Jesus almost never uses that title to describe himself. Instead, he very often uses the phrase the Son of Man.
Yeah.
This is a phrase that he got from Daniel chapter 7. And it's clear that Jesus saw Daniel 7 as a symbolic portrait in miniature of his entire destiny, calling, and vocation.
His identity.
His identity.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then what we did was go back to, because Daniel 7 is itself the whole story of the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah, Daniel 7 didn't just pop up out of nowhere.
No.
It wasn't just some random dream.
Yeah.
It was a culminating vision of an idea that's been generating since the first two pages of the Bible.
Literally, yeah, since the very beginning. So yeah, Daniel 7 is the whole Hebrew Bible told in one chapter of dense symbolism and dream imagery. Hmm.
Hebrew Bible.
Yes. And almost every key character, every key mediator or deliverer figure, human, contributes to the portrait. Actually, think of this figure we're going to see in Daniel 7, the Son of Man, as those like photo mosaics, you know, big pictures that are made of thousands of little tiny pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel 7's like that.
Hmm.
The Son of Man figure rising up above the defeated beast and being enthroned beside God. That figure is, if you zoom in, you'll see a million little pictures of Adam and Joseph and Moses and Joshua and the high priest. And we're going to see Daniel himself.
Huh.
And you realize all of their stories have been miniature versions of this story. There's just one storyline. At work and in all these different. There's one meta story being told over and over and over again through the mini stories of all the different episodes and characters of the Hebrew Bible. And it's the story from the early chapters of Genesis.
So the character, the Son of Man in Daniel 7 is like an amalgamation.
Correct. Yeah.
Of all of these other stories.
Yes.
And what you realize when you get there is that we haven't been telling all these separate stories of all these separate individuals.
Yeah.
It's all been one story, one meta story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By the time you get to this, you probably already kind of picked that up.
You're supposed to have been trained already to know that's what's going on.
That seems so significant. And then this is what Jesus calls himself.
Right. Yes. And so then it's why the gospel authors will have woven into every episode of the Gospels design patterns and keyword hyperlinks back to stories in the Hebrew Bible to depict Jesus as a new Adam, a new Joseph, a new Moses, a new Elijah, a new David. They'll tell stories of Jesus doing something.
Yeah.
But then he'll say something that's a little hyperlink or a quote from something Moses said or something.
Because the gospel authors don't like to just straight out just go, I want you to understand Jesus is a new Moses.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they do it the way the Hebrew Bible does it.
By having him do something, you're like, wait, that's something Moses would do. Or use a phrase of like, that's a phrase that's from the story
Moses
of Moses.
Did. That's something Moses did. That's something David did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the weave of biblical literature. Mm-hmm. biblical authors advance their claims and arguments and what they want to communicate to you, the message, but through narrative patterning to create overlapping characters. And so the Son of Man is the greatest example of that. But the Son of Man is in Daniel 7, which is the culmination of Daniel 1 through 6. And so we need to take in Daniel 1 through 6 real quick, a few minutes.
Story
and then
of Daniel.
It'll set us up. First sentences of Daniel. Let's just take this in.
Okay.
In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it.
Nebuchadnezzar,
yeah.
How do you pronounce it?
Nebuchadnezzar. And actually, that's a Hebrew pronunciation.
Of a Babylonian name.
Yeah, the Babylonian name is Nebuchadrezzar, with an R instead of an N. Not Netzar, but Retzar. Nebuchadrezzar. And Nebu is one of the names.
It's a god.
Mm-hmm. It's a deity. Yeah. In the book of Jeremiah, a couple times in the Hebrew Bible, the spelling Nebuchadrezzar is retained, even in Hebrew. But most times it's Nebuchadnezzar, and it's just a pronunciation variant. You know, like in like tomato, tomato, potato, potato.
Yeah, but those all have the same
letters. Oh, yeah. What's another one then?
You know what I always found really interesting is how the British always put kind of an R sound behind words that end with an A.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Like a gender. Or a banana.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Yeah, that's a good example.
It's just like this really soft R.
Mm-hmm.
In American English,
you
keep the A really strong and you end with that.
Yeah.
Banana.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, yes, I have a friend actually staying with me because he's about to move to Scotland. And he made dinner last night at our house. It was awesome. But he used something with Worcestershire sauce.
Oh, yeah.
It's spelled Worcestershire in English.
Yeah.
But he's saying in Scotland, they just say Worcester.
Worcester.
So Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So his name means Nabu is the name of a Babylonian god. I think it's a synonym for Marduk. So it means, so in Babylonian, it's Nabu Kuduru Utsur. Nabu has protected the son who will inherit. That's apparently what it means.
That's what the name means.
In Akkadian. Yeah.
Now, it doesn't really matter so much, but what do you know about this guy? Like, how do you come to power? And like, what's the whole Babylonian story?
He represents, he's a king of what's called the Neo-Babylonian Empire.
Okay.
So it's a rising from the ashes.
Oh.
So actually before Israel was ever on the scene, Babylon had an ancient, powerful empire over the Mesopotamian region. King Hammurabi is kind of the famous king. And Hammurabi's this big ancient stone where he inscribed a law code and that was given to him by the gods. So then the Assyrian kingdom, which was capital in Nineveh, which was up by the Tigris, a little bit north, gained power, and then it was just Assyria all the way for centuries. Mm. And so...
But Assyria didn't... They took over the northern kingdom.
They took out the northern kingdom, and they besieged Jerusalem during the reign of Hezekiah.
Okay.
And that story's told in the Bible multiple times. So, Nebuchadrezzar essentially was the architect of a renewal of the Babylonian Empire. And he was able to exploit a succession of lots of kings in a row in the Assyrian Empire. It was weak, economically weak. They had spent way too much money taking over the world, and way overextended. And so, anyway, he was able to take advantage of a bunch of things. There's lots of details I am forgetting right now. But anyway.
He rallied Babylon.
Yeah, this is a written, and we're talking, this is ancient. So this is happening in like around 600 BC. The golden days of Babylon were in like 1800 BC, so over 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So over 1,000 years.
It's just kind of been laying
Babylon's
dormant.
Babylon's been dormant.
Yeah.
Under the shadow of Assyria, and now he was the one.
So what was Israel up to when Babylon had its first kind of heyday?
Oh, yeah. They were Abraham's ancestors.
Okay.
In that very land, the land of Mesopotamia.
It was pre-Abraham.
Correct. So, yeah, all that to say, Babylon's ancient, but it's a Neo-Babylonian
era. This is Neo-Babylon.
And so, Nebuchadrezzar essentially stormed west and was asserting his dominance over what used to be the territory of the Assyrian Empire. This Neo-Babylonian era didn't last even a century.
Oh.
I mean, it just overextended itself, just like Assyria. The Persians, who came... Next, Persian Empire, they learned from Assyria and Babylon. What they did was, let all the people that Nebuchadnezzar had exiled and taken prisoner into foreign lands, he let these people go back.
Okay, yeah. This is why...
This is Cyrus.
And this is why Israel is able to go back to Jerusalem.
Yeah, after Ezra, Nehemiah's and Zerubbabel's period, there are books of the Bible about this. But what Ezra, Nehemiah, and that whole crew going back to Jerusalem, that was a part of many people groups getting to go back to their homelands after having been taken into exile by Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah, but that was just normal. You're like, we're going to be the power brokers here in this world, and so you're going to all be under my authority, and I'm going to march in, and now, you're going to... Make
however, that's right. However, what Nebuchadnezzar did first is he asserted dominance over Jerusalem. He besieged it. That's how the book of Daniel opens. And as we're going to see, he took a whole layer of the elite power economic brokers, and he took them to Babylon.
Yeah.
But he left the majority of the population, and he set up a puppet king. And then it's the puppet king, Zedekiah, who rebels. And then Nebuchadnezzar comes back and he's like, you guys are done for.
I gave you your shot. Yeah.
So there were actually multiple waves of
Nebuchadnezzar
coming and taking people.
So he didn't just come in and just take over. I mean, he did.
Yeah, he
did. But he came in and he's like, I'm going to let you guys keep this.
You know, keep this. You'll just be under foreign occupation and
the
guy ruling is under my thumb. That's right. So Daniel is a part of this first wave of exiles. All of that is told in the book of 2 Kings.
Okay.
And Daniel opens with a hyperlink back, essentially back to 2 Kings. In the third year of Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem and besieged it.
Jehoiakim being?
He was the current...
he was the puppet ruler?
Line of David. No. No, he was the guy reigning when Nebuchadnezzar showed up.
Oh, first time.
So, verse 2, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand.
Yeah.
Just like Jeremiah said, just like the prophet said, rebel... Sons of David don't get to rule in Jerusalem for very long. Yahweh won't allow it. So here's what happened. The Lord gave the king of Judah, the son of David, into this guy's hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. So he looted the temple, took all the gold, lampstand, the table of showbread.
Yeah, which isn't like if you're trying to make friends with the Israelites, it's not
a
good thing to
do. No, he doesn't care about being friends. He's asserting dominance.
Yeah, it's very Machiavellian, though, or whatever.
Totally. Well, like, then look what he does. He empties the temple of all of its like ritual furniture, and then he brought them to the land of Shinar, and that's a little hyperlink. It means Babylon. It's a regional name for Babylon.
Yeah, NIV says Babylonia.
Oh, wow. Okay, it's the land of Shinar.
Shinar, yeah, Hebrew
it's
Shinar.
It's a glowing blue hyperlink.
Yeah.
Because this is where the tower and the city of Babylon were built in Genesis 11. It's called the land of Shinar.
That's where the Tower of Babel was built.
It's a rare ancient name for the region of Babylon.
Yeah.
We encountered it first in Genesis 11.
Okay.
And it's used just a few times in the whole Hebrew Bible.
Oh, interesting.
And they're always meant to be hyperlinks back. So remember, what was Genesis 11 about? What's that tower of Babylon that has its head up in the heavens? Yeah. It's a temple structure.
Oh, okay.
And so he's taking them back to the Babylonian cosmic mountain temple. And he's taking what used to be in the temple in Jerusalem, and he's putting it in the temple to his God.
Yeah. Devastating.
Devastating. Yeah. 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 He's throwing his weight around. So, verse 3, then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to take some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal seed. Mm. Literally, the seed of the kingdom.
Mm. Yeah.
And by now, the word seed...
Yeah, it's a loaded hyperlink too.
Yeah, the seed of the woman, seed of Abraham,
yeah,
seed of David, part of the messianic portrait is the royal seed.
Yeah, within the seed is the future hope of the whole
snake
nation.
Snake crusher
yeah.
of the one who will bring God's kingdom and bring blessing to the nation, seed of Abraham, all that.
Yeah, so that's interesting. Yeah. It's like this detail of taking the royal seed.
Yes.
Well, first he takes all of these, like the really important artifacts, like the important...
Yeah, he empties the temple.
All the temple worship stuff.
Yeah.
It's like going in and robbing God's house.
Yep.
But even more than that, the most valuable thing...
Yeah, the future of their kingdom.
Is the future of the kingdom symbolized in the seed, the promise that God would use.
Yeah.
And he's taking that.
Taking that to Babylon too.
Yeah.
Yep. Let's think about these royal seed. They're youths in whom there was no blemish.
Like they're priests.
Ah, like their priests and like the sacrificial animals.
Oh.
It's a phrase used to describe like Passover, take a young yearling with no blemish.
Yeah.
Where all the sacrifices in Leviticus.
Yeah.
Take an animal.
Yeah.
With no blemishes. Why are they being described as if they're sacrificial animals?
Hmm. Interesting.
Right? Animals get consumed by the flames on the altar.
Yeah. But it also is a description of a priest, right?
Correct. The priests are to have no blemish, but also the animals.
Okay.
Correct. Yep. They were also good of sight.
Mm-hmm. Mm. They're good on the eyes.
Good on the eyes, which is what was said of both David and of Joseph, the same phrase.
Yeah.
And also, it's what that forbidden fruit looked like to the woman.
Oh, really? Is it the same phrase?
Good of sight.
Good of sight.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
And you know
NIV
what?
NIV just says handsome.
Okay. Handsome. You know what else is interesting? They had knowledge in every kind of wisdom.
Hmm.
Endowed with understanding, discernment, and knowledge to serve in the king's court. So we have the royal seed going into the heart of Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
And they are described in the language of priests and sacrificial animals. And they have wisdom, and they look good, which is just like that fruit in the garden that would bring wisdom if you take it. Remember?
Yeah.
The woman saw that the fruit was good
of
sight and desirable for gaining knowledge to become wise.
So you think that's all in here?
Oh, absolutely. No doubt.
Really?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Is there...
Totally. Totally.
That's a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but by this just point in the Hebrew Bible, it's already pre-programmed, specifically from the Joseph story. This is all language from the Joseph story, where Joseph is the forbidden fruit that Potiphar's wife sees and desires and takes.
Huh. So these guys are now the fruit that Nebuchadnezzar's taking?
Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar's just taken
That's why they're described this way?
The forbidden fruit of the chosen royal seed.
Hmm.
And it's going to come back to bite him in a major way.
Okay.
But anyway, just to...
All right.
Yeah. Okay. So here's what happens. By now in the Hebrew Bible, these authors are very creative, and they'll be using imagery and language from earlier stories, but in new combinations.
Okay.
They're not beholden to the earlier stories. They use them as treasure troves of imagery to make the point that needs to be made here in Daniel.
Okay.
So here's what happens is that the king appoints that these guys eat from the king's choice food and from his wine and to get schooled in Babylonian astronomy and math and language for 3 years.
Yeah.
Before they entered the service.
Not a bad gig.
Among them were four sons of Judah, four of the royal seed, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So Daniel means God is my judge, the one who judges on my behalf.
Okay.
Hananiah means Yahweh shows mercy. Mishael, who is like El, who is like God.
Mm-hmm.
And Azariah is Yahweh is help.
Hmm. So they all have really great Hebrew names.
They all have awesome Hebrew names. And what he does is they get assigned new Babylonian names.
Hmm.
Belteshazzar.
For Daniel.
Yep. Shadrach. And again, so Belteshazzar here, I'll just look these up real quick. Belteshazzar. So Daniel goes from God is my judge to Balatsari Utsur. May the king's life be protected.
Oh, wow.
So his name goes from God as my protector and judge.
To I protect the king of Babylon.
May the life of the king of Babylon be protected.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
That is interesting.
Yeah. It's cool stuff like this. Okay. So here's the thing. All right. Daniel's got a new diet and a new educational track in front of him.
And a new name.
But here's the thing. He already has wisdom.
That's right.
Doesn't he? Yeah. So next, verse 8. So Daniel made up his mind. I'm not going to defile myself with this Babylonian food.
Yeah.
Or the wine.
And for him, because it's not kosher, right?
Almost certainly. Yeah. That's what's going on.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. So we have a figure here to the king of Babylon. He's treating these royal seed like they're like the forbidden fruit that he's taken.
Mm-hmm. He's going to plump them up.
Yeah, totally. But from another perspective, here's Daniel as the royal seed,
mm-hmm.
a human, mm-hmm. being taken and planted in Babylon, and he won't eat food that's forbidden to him.
Mm.
So it's this contrast. The king of Babylon will take what doesn't belong to him.
Yeah.
Like the humans on page one taking the fruit, and they're described like the fruit.
But Daniel won't.
But Daniel won't eat the forbidden food. He becomes a reversal of an Adam figure.
Yeah, he's the Adam we're looking for.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. Nebuchadnezzar becomes, we know humans.
We know this story.
We know humans who desire and take what they want for themselves.
Yeah.
We've seen that all over.
Yeah.
But Daniel, all of a sudden, we're like, whoa, this guy.
He didn't do it.
He doesn't take what is forbidden to him.
Mm.
And his life is at stake. All of a sudden, the king gets angry that he and his friends won't eat the royal food. And so Daniel says, wait, okay, if you can kill me if you want, but just give us some time, 10 days. And if we're more healthy and our brains are working better than anybody else here after 10 days of only eating seeds, he says, give us 10 days. I think it's good.
Which is what God wanted Adam and Eve to eat in the garden?
Yes. Yes, dude. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So Daniel says, I don't want the king's food. Then he strikes a deal down here. Yeah, in verse 12, he says, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given some vegetables, is how
it gets
translated. But the word is zeroim, a plural of the Hebrew word zera.
Which is seed.
Word zera, which is seed.
Huh.
So here's the royal seed
yeah.
who's asking to eat only seed. And this was the diet given to the humans in Genesis 1,
yeah.
the seed-bearing plants.
Yeah.
And so it says, so he's like
Daniel's a vegan.
Totally, yeah. We're like, he's a new Adam.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
This is the new, oh, cool. Yeah.
He won't eat the forbidden food.
Yeah.
Instead, he'll eat what God's assigned him, which is the seed-bearing plants.
Hmm.
And then after 10 days.
But he's not in the Garden of Eden.
No. He's in the anti-Eden. He's in Babylon.
Yeah.
Which in Genesis 3-11.
Is the anti-Eden.
Is where the expulsion from Eden landed humanity.
Yeah.
Is in the plains of Shinar.
Mm.
It's all connected, dude. So awesome how these stories work. Okay. 10 days pass and their bodies are healthy. They're smarter. Verse 17, God gave them knowledge and intelligence. And Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. And then they enter into the king's service. That's Daniel chapter 1.
Okay.
So we're already set up to see Daniel as a royal son of David who's a new Adam.
Mm-hmm.
He passed his test.
Yeah.
Just like
He didn't take.
Yeah. The royal priest on Genesis 1, Adam and Eve, right? They failed the test.
Yeah. And they had everything going for them.
Yeah, totally.
Right?
Yeah.
They're in the garden.
They're actually in Eden. Yeah.
Yeah. Everything's awesome. They're walking with God. The temple garden.
Mm-hmm.
They're living there.
Yeah.
And they screw it up. Mm-hmm. Yet Daniel, he's pulled out of the temple's destroyed in Jerusalem,
yeah.
or ransacked.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
He's pulled into the anti-Eden. Mm-hmm. He's now essentially the slave of a guy who thinks he's God.
Yeah.
His name has been changed.
Yeah.
And he's got to protect this guy now.
Yep. And a test is put before him regarding forbidden food.
Yeah. Man, the kosher diet's so important. Mm. And mm-hmm. to the mm-hmm. storyline, and even in Acts.
Yes. Yeah. That's right.
How?
The forbidden food.
It's such an important part. And like when the Jerusalem Christians mm-hmm. told the Gentile Christians, like, I just do whatever.
Yes. Yeah.
Just these two things.
Here it's what sets Daniel apart as faithful to God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they say, just don't eat food sacrificed. No. Or,
yeah,
what did they say?
Sacrificed to idols.
And with blood in it, right?
Correct. Yeah. Or strangled. That's been strangled.
That's been strangled.
Yeah.
They still cared about the diet.
Yeah, they did.
That was really still important to them.
That's right. Yeah.
It was such a symbol.
Huge. Huge.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, so Daniel, the new Adam, passed his test,
mm-hmm.
and now he's super smart and super wise, and then we're told he can understand visions and dreams.
Yeah.
And behold, what is Daniel chapter 2 all about?
A dream.
A dream that the king of Babylon has. He has this dream of a great statue made up of multiple kinds of metals, but it's a big statue representing the empires and kingdoms of the world. And it gets struck by a meteor. And then he wakes up and he's freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
And he calls all his wizards and dream interpreters. And no one can figure it out.
Yeah.
So he says, I'm going to kill you all. He just issues an edict. All my staff, I'm going to kill all my staff and hire new people.
Sheesh.
Can you imagine?
No.
It's good to let that sink in for a second. This is human nature right here.
We live in such a unique time in history because that seems outlandish to us, but probably in most times in human history, that was par for the course.
Yep. Heads are going to roll.
Growing up, I remember watching this movie about this city that like had all this gold, and like there's this one scene in it. It's a very old movie. It's one scene in it. The like ruler was just mad at this guy, so he just like dropped him in this like boiling cauldron of gold.
Yeah.
And then the guy's just dead, and I'm just like, I just remember as a kid just watching him be like, whoa, that is so gnarly.
Yeah.
He just killed that dude
in
his pot of gold.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, that's kind of like the same feeling I'm getting.
Become the icon.
of like Nebuchadnezzar just being like, you guys can't do it? All right, you're all dead.
Yes.
Bring me a new crew.
Yep. Yeah, dude.
Put him in the pot of gold.
Yes. Human beings, man. Animals.
Yeah.
That's what this video is going to be about. The animal nature unleashed in humans when we don't submit to a definition of good and evil greater than my definition. So Daniel asks for a couple days to pray to his God because he's like, I know I can come up with the interpretation of the dream.
Yeah,
and so he does, and he goes to Nebuchadnezzar and he says, "Listen, the statue that you saw are the kingdoms of this world. There's four layers. It's a succession of four kingdoms, you and the ones coming after you. And you know what you should do is you should honor the God of all nations and be a good ruler, be a good king.
Yeah.
You know? And Nebuchadnezzar's...
By the way, this is not... If Daniel is being smart, he wouldn't have brought that interpretation, right?
Oh, yeah, sure. In other words, to say that your kingdom is eventually going to fall. And Yeah, that's right.
It's like getting summoned by...
Totally.
Yeah.
That's right. And that eventually the whole chain of kingdoms is going to collapse. And God's kingdom comes, the meteor comes, strikes.
Yeah. You're not bringing good news is what I'm saying.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. So think the images of a great statue reaching up into the skies.
Yeah.
Its head is in the sky, so to speak.
Yeah, okay.
Just like the Tower of Babylon. Let's build a tower with its head.
This is the dream that Neb has. Okay.
Then the meteor comes, the rock that represents God's kingdom, that's how he interprets it, And then all of a sudden that rock grows into a cosmic mountain.
Yeah.
That's what he says.
Yeah.
A mountain. So in place of the human mountain, so to speak, or the image that goes up to the sky.
The anti-Eden becoming Eden again.
The anti-Eden is destroyed and God's cosmic mountain.
Which is not what happens when a meteor hits the earth. You get an upside, you get a crater.
I know. Yeah, isn't that interesting?
You don't get a mountain.
That's a good point. Yeah, at this point, again, so it's a dream.
Yeah.
It's all symbolic.
Yeah.
Meteors can become mountains.
Meteors become mountains.
In your dreams. So, it's very important. The king's response to Daniel is in chapter 2, verse 46. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, and New American Standard has did homage to Daniel. Are you looking at NIV translation?
Mm-hmm. Paid him honor.
Paid him honor. And gave orders to present him an offering and sweet incense, fragrant incense.
Hmm. Yeah, this went well for Daniel.
This went well for Daniel. Okay, but just stop. So the king of the nations who just plundered you and your people is now on his face before Daniel. And paying honors, it's the word for worship.
Oh, that phrase, and paid him honor, the Hebrew there is worshiped.
Yep. So the king who just had a dream about a statue representing the empires, when he realizes that Daniel can interpret the dream, he prostrates himself and he worships Daniel and offers sacrifices to him before him. Do you see this?
Yeah.
To present him an offering, an incense, means this is the language of worship in the book of Leviticus.
This is what you do at a temple.
You kill an animal, you burn it in before the altar, before the Holy of Holies, and you offer incense as an act of worship.
He's treating Daniel like a king.
The king who thinks he's a god is bowing and worshiping Daniel as if he's a god. Hmm. What? That's crazy. Mm-hmm. This is a total inversion of the storyline. Hmm. And you're also a little scandalized. You're like, he's a pagan. He's a Babylonian. He worships all kinds of things.
Yeah.
But, you know, in biblical imagery, this is very stark. The king says to Daniel, surely your God is the God of gods, the Elohim of Elohim, the Lord of lords, the revealer of mysteries. So you're like, wait, so he's worshiping Daniel.
Yeah.
But then the one he's also honoring.
Yeah.
His worship to Daniel is a form of worship.
To Daniel's God.
To Daniel's God.
Yeah.
But the text is very clear. He laid down prostrate before Daniel and presented to him.
For Nebuchadnezzar, something special about Daniel, and he knows that behind Daniel is Daniel's God.
Yes.
But we also know from the biblical narrative that Daniel's God has anointed humans.
Yes, as his image.
As his image.
Yes.
Yeah. And we've been presented already as Daniel as kind of this true human
a
character.
Truly human image, a true image of God who passed the test.
Yeah,
he passed the test. In the anti-Eden.
Yeah.
And then here are the nations. The representative of the nations bowing before the faithful image of God and offering him worship. Hmm. I'm just saying.
What are you saying?
Remember, Daniel 7 is the culmination
of
both the biblical story and also of the lead up of Daniel.
This is a son of man picture.
Yeah, here's the son of Adam who's passed the test and the nations are bowing before him.
Hmm. Yeah.
So the next chapter is Daniel chapter 3. Mm-hmm. This is one of the most famous stories in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And it's an inversion of what just happened. It begins, Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits. If a cubit's, what, 18, about a foot and a half.
90 feet high by 90 feet wide.
Yeah, I mean,
that's a Statue of Liberty sized. How big is the Statue of Liberty? 305 feet tall.
Oh, got it.
So it's a third.
A third, which is still big.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still really big.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Okay. Nebuchadnezzar just fell down and worshipped the God of Israel by worshipping his image, represented by Daniel.
Mm-hmm. And now he wants an image of himself.
Nebuchadnezzar making, in reality, what he just had a dream about, image. These stories are so
old habits die hard.
Old habits die hard. So he's like, you know, I had a dream about this really cool image.
Yeah. Let's see if God can really knock the head off
this thing.
I was
the head of gold, so I'll just make the whole thing gold.
Yeah.
Right.
When you have that much gold to your name, I mean, why not make it statue of yourself.
I guess. Just kind of like, remember Solomon's throne with the lions on the steps?
Yeah.
You were enjoying that throne when we talked about it.
Totally.
You're like, I would make one of
those. I would make that throne. Oh, man.
Okay. All right. So Nebuchadnezzar makes this image, and he also makes an edict, passes an edict through the land.
Mm-hmm.
In verse 4, he says, to you, the command is given, all you peoples and nations and languages.
Mm-hmm.
He summons them all before the image.
Yeah.
It's the same Hebrew. Well, actually, now we're in the Aramaic.
Oh, we're in Aramaic.
Section, but it's Salama. It's the same three letters.
Oh.
As in Hebrew, it's Salam. He says, at the moment you hear the sound of all these instruments, the horn, the flute, they have a whole symphony.
Yeah.
In the orchestra pit in front of the statue. What you are to do is to fall down and worship the image of gold. This is an inversion of what just happened at the end of chapter 2.
Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar worshiped Daniel.
This is exactly the same vocabulary. So after the dream the image.
Well, why is it translated worship in NIV here and not
I know
in the last chapter?
I know. I think because it's describing Daniel as the object of the verb.
And
I think our translators think, like, we can't translate that worship. He's not worshiping Daniel.
Yeah, it's not what he's supposed to be doing.
But he is.
Yeah.
Like, at the end of the dream about the statue, it straight up says it. He worshiped Daniel and offered sacrifices to him.
Yeah.
Straight up. So, and actually, here, I'm going off the work of a couple scholars here who have thoroughly studied this out here. And it's totally what's happening. I love how Daniel 2 and 3 are inversions of each other.
Yeah.
Daniel 2, the king, has a dream about an image of his empire. And then he worships Daniel as the image of God for interpreting the dream. Now, the king of the nations is summoning the nation to worship an image of him.
Yeah.
In the same vocabulary as what he did to Daniel. But he says, anybody who doesn't fall down and worship the image like he did to Daniel will be thrown into the blazing fire.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh no. And this is a famous story.
Yep.
And then that hyperlink from chapter 1 of Daniel and his friends described as people in whom there is no defect or no blemish. You're like, oh yeah, they are sacrificial lambs after all.
Yeah.
Being burned before the image, so to speak, for not worshiping the false image.
I see where this is going.
Yeah, totally. So there you go. The story happens. They don't, you know, the three friends, they don't worship the image.
They don't worship.
They are offered as a sacrifice.
Yeah.
Before, right? The altar of Babylon, so to speak. And then all of a sudden a fourth person that looks like a son of the gods appears next to the friends in the furnace. This is in verse 25.
Okay.
Verse 24 and 25. It says, Nebuchadnezzar was astounded that fire was burning, but they were not incinerated.
Mm-hmm.
And an official says to him in verse 24, wasn't it three humans we bound and cast into the fire?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, O king. Well, I see four humans walking around in the fire, not being harmed. And you know what that fourth looks like? He looks like a son of Elohim.
Which, that phrase can refer to a human, right? Son of Elohim.
Oh, got it. The king, the son of David, is adopted as a son of God.
Okay.
Yep. And that's what these guys are. They're part of the royal seed of David.
Yeah.
And also Israel as a whole, like in the Exodus story, can be called the son of God.
Oh, okay. But it's a royal title. It's a royal title.
Yeah. Yeah. And spiritual beings
are called
son
of gods.
The delegated authorities over the nations.
So here he's saying that there's a spirit being in there.
Yeah, there's a supernatural being in there with them.
Yeah.
So that's significant,
obviously.
But then when he invites them to come out, only three come out.
Yeah.
Unsinged, not even their hair smells like smoke and nothing's damaged. Right? It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And so what he does is he says, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel, his malak, his messenger.
His messenger, yeah.
Yep, so he interprets that as an angelic or supernatural being
who
saved his servants, who put their faith in him. They violated the king's command and gave up their bodies to not bow down and worship anyone except their own God. So he says, I make a decree. that anybody who says anything bad about the god of these guys will be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to rubbish heaps.
All right.
Okay, yeah, all right. Okay, there's that story. Daniel 4.
Okay, another dream.
The king, he says, chapter 4, verse 4, you know, I was at ease in my house, flourishing in my palace.
Yeah, so day good. Of a king.
Yeah, so good. And I had a dream, and it freaked me out. And here's what it was. He has this dream about a tree.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge tree, and it's beautiful. It has all this fruit, and all of the beasts of the field, and the birds of the sky, and the living creatures come, and they eat the fruit, and they have shelter and shade.
Hmm.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
But then, verse 13, a watcher, a holy one, descended from the heavens. Verse 13.
Hmm.
A watcher.
A watcher.
A watcher.
I have a little note here.
Mm-hmm.
NIV's messenger, and then it says, or watchman.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
A watcher.
Yeah.
That name has very creepy connotations in kind of modern English.
Mm.
Like the watchers. Like I feel like in different different stories, they're always a little...
Watchers?
Watchers, yeah.
Yeah.
There was this kind of like X-Files reboot kind of thing called, what was it called? Fringe or something. And the whole storyline of these Watchers characters, they were just kind of like exact same kind of characters.
Yeah.
They just observe.
Yeah.
They come in to like make sure certain things don't go awry, but they're just kind of like these kind of, sovereign kind of characters.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's... part of the heritage of the biblical watchers in the biblical tradition. The idea of these super beings, who represent the eye of the heavens on the events of humanity, the universe, and so on. So that's all a heritage from the biblical watchers. This is the only time that this word is used to describe these creatures in the Hebrew Bible. However... in a work contemporary with Daniel in its final shape, in its final shape of the Hebrew Bible, in the book of First Enoch, the Watchers is the name of the sons of Elohim from Genesis 6.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the angels are the Watchers.
So the, well, again, the sons of Elohim.
Right.
The spiritual beings that God appointed to rule over the heavens,
uh-huh.
who violated the boundary and came down.
You don't want me to use the word angel.
Not yet. even though angel is what they will come to be called, but that's a later blurring of an original distinction.
Blurring.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Essentially, in the Hebrew Bible, the sons of Elohim, here one of them called a watcher, represents the spiritual beings that God delegated to rule on His behalf over the heavens.
Okay.
And that's distinct from the category of spiritual beings called malak. Or angelos, angels,
because
those can be spiritual or human.
Yeah,
that's a human or spiritual being role, and what they're errand people. Mm. They run errands and send
angels. Angels a way to describe what someone's doing more
that's
than
right.
what they are.
Correct. Yeah. So what happens though in post-biblical literature, Jewish literature, is that
they stopped calling sons of God or.
Actually, they keep doing it, but the word angel developed its meaning to cover both categories.
Okay.
And so by the New Testament, you get Michael or Gabriel showing up to somebody.
And he's called an angel.
And he's called an angelos. Yeah. So these watchers, and this is all back to the scattering of Babylon and Deuteronomy 32.
Yeah.
The sons of Elohim.
Yeah.
Over
and we
the
talked
nations.
About this in our God
Correct.
Series conversation.
Correct. So the dream here is essentially that the watcher, right, comes down. He's called a holy one. He descends and he shouts, chop down the tree, cut off the branches, strip all the leaves, scatter the fruit. All the beasts and birds need to flee and just leave that stump in the ground. Oh, and then put a big iron bronze prison shackle around the stump.
This guy doesn't like this tree.
Yeah, totally. And in the new grass that'll grow up after the chopping down, let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. You're like, who's the him? So apparently this chopped down tree has morphed into a human.
Oh.
And that's what it is. It's going to be Nebuchadnezzar.
The tree represents Nebuchadnezzar.
The tree, he's having a dream about himself, represented as a tree. But the moment he's cut down and falls on the ground, he becomes a human laying in the wet grass.
Got it.
Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him share with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let him eat grass.
Mm.
Let his heart be changed from that of a human, and let the heart of a beast be given to him.
Heart?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a beast has mind.
Yes. Right. But remember, there's no word for brain or mind in Hebrew.
It's the word heart. Okay. I see.
Yeah. So a human, this is in this dream, King Nebuchadnezzar, represented as the tree of life to all the world.
Yeah.
But he's going to be chopped down, and then that tree is going to morph into a naked human laying in the wet grass, and then the naked human becomes a beast.
That's the image.
That's the dream.
Wow.
And we're told that this is a sentence decreed by the watchers.
Mm.
And the watchers represent, they're God's delegates. So this is God's decision.
Yeah.
But that he passed on and let the watchers make to let Babylon fall.
Mm.
It's the decision of the holy ones so that all the living may know that the Most High above who commissioned the watchers, that he is the ruler over the realm of humans. He bestows rule on whom he wishes, and he loves to set rule over the lowliest of humans.
Mm.
This is the dream that I, Nebuchadnezzar, saw. And then he gets Daniel, and Daniel interprets the dream.
Sounds like he just interpreted his own dream.
He just recounted the dream.
Oh.
Daniel's going to go on to say, you are the tree.
Mm. But what was the whole thing? I lost you when you were reading about God likes to... verse was something about...
Chapter 4, verse 17. This is the decree of the watchers, so that all the living may know that the Most High rules over the realm of humans. And he bestows rule on whomever he wishes, and he sets it over or on the lowliest of humans. This is the last line of verse 17.
Yeah. What is he talking about?
So... he just brought down the arrogant and proud, Babylon, and God is the one who assigns kingdoms rising and falling.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what God takes particular delight in? It's chopping down big arrogant kingdoms that think they're awesome.
Yeah.
And he loves to set the opportunity to rule on the humble no-names.
Mm. Yeah, and this upside down kingdom
totally
stuff.
And this is all from Abraham, the no-name Abraham who's given a name. David, the eighth forgotten one.
The weak become strong.
The out with the sheep.
Mm.
Hannah, right? The one who has no children, being exalted over Peninnah and giving birth to Samuel.
Yeah.
It's a major motif. Yeah. When humans exalt themselves, they activate the inner animal and become beasts, that God will chop them down, exile them to the wilderness to be with the beasts that they act like. And he loves then to replace them by exalting the humble no name to rule in the place of the kingdoms. So good, dude.
That's so interesting. I mean, we've talked about this a lot, this upside down kingdom stuff. Jesus riffs. I mean, he's
huge.
All about this.
All about this.
And when it starts to get very practical, it's a very strange, you just don't see any like self-help type books that are like, hey, look, just be weak.
Yeah, totally.
God wants to like...
Or the true way to honor God with whatever privilege or authority, influence that you have, is to give that influence and authority away to others and include them and exalt them.
Yeah.
In some way. There's different ways to embody that ethic, but it's the upside down ethic.
And if you're going to keep it all to yourself, he's going to just chop you down.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, God exalts.
But this tree in the dream is a pretty rad tree.
Yeah, it's totally, okay, let's talk about this.
Yeah.
It's the tree of life. It's an image of Eden and the tree of life.
Yeah.
So it's as if Babylon could, if it wanted to, it could become an expression of God's rule over the nations.
It reminded me of when God told Adam said, hey, they know good and evil now. They're like us.
They're going to send out their hand and take from the tree of life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of this sense of like, we're capable of so much.
Yeah.
But if we do it on our own terms, it's going to get really ugly.
Totally. That's right.
But it might even look really beautiful.
It might look beautiful.
Yeah.
Just like the Hanging Gardens of Babylon.
Yeah.
Little Edens. Little I'm sure Edens. It looked beautiful. Mm. But underneath it was...
Babylon from one perspective looked like the Tree of Life.
Correct. Yep. Because it has the possibility to, just like every human life has the possibility to...
And every human institution.
To be truly human.
Yeah.
And every human institution made up of lots of humans.
Yeah.
Has a chance to represent the reign and rule of God.
Mm.
But it all is about who gets to define the knowledge of good and evil
mm.
and whether the tree will bear fruit that really just benefits everybody else.
Yeah.
That's the idea.
But this tree is benefiting. It's benefiting everyone else mm. in the vision,
mm.
right?
Mm.
The birds
that's right. Yeah,
and
that's
the
right.
animals.
Okay,
and the...
yeah. So the point is whether the tree represents Babylon as it was or Babylon as it could be. Because the point is here's a tree, and then it's chopped down.
I guess the question is, like, what's wrong with this tree? Why not just let the tree go and yeah. just prune it as you need to?
Yeah.
Why chop it down? Like, at I this see. Point, and it's not true because Nebuchadnezzar is out there throwing people in fiery furnaces and stuff.
Yeah, totally.
Right?
Yeah.
So right. there's some gnarly right. stuff happening under yeah. the under the shade of this tree.
Yeah.
But in the dream,
yes.
is it because...
Actually, here, this is the tree represents what Babylon could become based on what Nebuchadnezzar does in response to this dream.
Oh, interesting.
Because look, and after he gets Daniel in the room, mm-hmm. tells him the dream,
yeah.
Daniel interprets the dream, and he says, listen, you know, the tree is you, and you're going...
It's a future him.
Correct. He says, the tree's going to be chopped down, and you're... This is chapter 4, verse 25. You're going to be driven away, exiled,
mm.
just like Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to live with the beasts and eat grass.
Yeah.
Do you remember? This is so cool.
Yeah, this is what the animals were given to eat
in Genesis 1.
Yeah.
So Daniel refuses to eat the forbidden food of Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah. And he eats the food allotted to him.
And he eats the food assigned to the humans in Genesis 1.
Yeah.
Nebuchadnezzar now, because he's, you know, going to be a rebel Adam figure, is going to be exiled with the beasts. And eat the diet of the animals.
Yeah.
Like the animal that he is. But then the ultimatum comes in verse 27. He says, now, therefore, O king, may my advice be pleasing to you. Break away from your sins.
Mm.
Do righteousness. Break away from your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor.
Mm.
So that there may be a prolonging of your abundance.
Mm.
So that's the idea.
God can use his kingdom
yeah,
he for good.
He could use it. Could yeah, this is as if it's almost, this becomes Nebuchadnezzar's test
mm.
in the garden.
Yeah.
I've never quite put it that way to myself, but that's exactly his dreams about the Garden of Eden, about
yeah,
how he could
this
become.
This is his Garden of Gethsemane moment in
oh,
a way.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
Not my will, but your will kind of thing.
Yeah, that's like, right. Yep.
This yeah. is the task at hand. How are you gonna handle it?
Will you let your life and the kingdom you rule bear fruit for the nations? Which here is equated by showing mercy to the poor. He just says it.
Yeah.
And that's Amos and Micah ringing in our ears. Mm-hmm. The true worship of the true
yeah,
God.
When this all gets practical, it's about taking care of other humans.
That's right.
That need it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you know an institution that apparently represents God's way of ruling the world when it takes care of and gives itself away for the well-being of others. Especially people who don't usually get access to the goods.
Yeah.
Yeah. He says, you have a chance. So.
Pretty different than just throwing people in boiling pots of gold.
it's the opposite.
It's the exact opposite.
It's exalting people to opportunities to. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Well.
Okay. The story goes on. Verse 29. 12 months later, Nebuchadnezzar was walking on the roof of his royal palace in Babylon. Then the king, I forget the idiom. Yeah, the king answered and said, isn't this Babylon the great, which I myself have built as a royal residence for the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty?
Yeah. It's getting to his head.
There you go. So this is his Adam and Eve moment. While the word was in his mouth, a voice came from heaven. Saying, King Nebuchadnezzar, your sovereignty is removed. You're driven away, exiled from humankind.
Wait, but he's just, wait,
He's just impressed with himself for a moment.
But come on. Come on. It's clearly this is...
You never done that? You never walked through your room and you're just like, look at this. This is nice. I got some nice stuff.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yes.
But this is the culminating moment.
Yeah. I mean, it's the test. It's the moment. The test.
What do you mean it's a test?
Well, like he just had the dream and he just...
Yeah, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do?
How are you
going
to rule?
The next story is about he's him going out and saying, yeah. It's all mine.
Yeah.
It's all mine for my power and my majesty and my glory.
Yeah. But it is interesting how, in one sense, that should ring as like this, what a, you know, he did it, he blew it. But in another sense, it's like, who hasn't done that?
Yeah, of course, yes. Yeah. He's a human.
He's human, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And so the dream comes to pass. He goes crazy, wanders out into the dewy grass, eats the diet of the animals from Genesis 1 for 7 periods of time. And then we're told in verse 33, his body was drenched with dew until his hair grew like that of an eagle's.
Sounds like awesome hair.
Eagle hair?
Eagle hair.
Eagles have feathers. And... his fingernails were like that of a bird's.
Yeah.
So weird. I mean, he's becoming a beast out there.
Yeah.
He's growing feather fur and claws.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something's happening here. In the narrative portrait, he's becoming a mutant. He's depicted as a mutant. A human become an animal mutant.
Yeah.
Which, again, it's all leading us up to Daniel 7.
Okay.
All right. So that's enough. We could do Daniel 5 and 6, but it'd just be the same things going forward.
Okay.
Daniel 5 is Nebuchadnezzar's son, has the same test put before him.
Mm-hmm.
He fails. Daniel 6 is another test for Daniel, whether he's going to pray to the king of the Medes as if he's a god. He doesn't, and he's thrown into a pit of beasts. Who usually crush bones, but instead they just sit there peacefully with Daniel. So Daniel 6.
Peace with the animals.
Daniel 6 is our new
Adam.
Oh
my goodness.
Sitting in a pit
at
peace with the animals.
Wow.
Daniel 6. At peace with the violent beasts.
Yeah.
Come on. What do you want? So then we walk into the mighty chapter. We haven't even talked about the literary design. In the literary design of Daniel 7.
It's a big chiasm leading to this.
Totally. It's the center point of the whole book.
Yeah.
Everything leads up to it, and the rest of the book flows out of it. And this was the most important chapter for Jesus in understanding his identity and his vocation. It's where he got the phrase, the Son of Man. This is the hot spot. We need to put on radiation suits.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Bible Project Podcast. If you've been enjoying this series and you have questions, we'd love to hear them. Feel free to send it to us at info@jointhebibleproject.com. We'll compile these questions for an upcoming question and response episode that we'll do at the tail end of the series. Again, that's info@jointhebibleproject.com. Send us an audio file of yourself asking the question and also tell us your name and where you're from. Try to keep it around 20 seconds or so. Also, our website's been updated, so it's easier to use, has a really cool design. Check it out, thebibleproject.com. On it, you'll find all of our free resources, including the podcast show notes of this series and all the series we've done. They're really helpful to follow along with since these conversations get really dense. Also, our Son of Man video is up on that website as well. Today's episode was produced by Dan Gummel, theme music by the band Tense. We're a crowdfunded nonprofit in Portland, Oregon, and all of this is made possible through the generous support of many people around the world, people like you. So thanks for being a part of this with us.
Hi, my name is Tete Fernandez, and I'm from Mexico. My favorite thing about the Bible Project is that I can learn about the Jewish roots of the scripture and see it through a new lens. We believe that the Bible is a unified story that leads to Jesus. We are a crowdfunded project by people like me. Find free videos, study notes, podcasts, and more resources at thebibleproject.com. Hola, mi nombre es Tete Fernández y soy de México. Mi parte favorita de The Bible Project es que puedo aprender mucho más de las raíces hebreas de nuestra fe y puedo entender la Biblia desde una perspectiva nueva. Creemos que la Biblia es una historia unificada que guía a Jesús. Somos una organización financiada por gente como yo. Encuentra videos gratis, notas de estudio, podcast y muchos más recursos at thebibleproject.com.